Hey there, it's Bill DeYoung once again with the St. Pete Catalyst and the Arts Alive podcast. Happy today to have as our guest Emily Capus, who is curator of art at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art. Hello, Emily.
Hello, Bill. Thanks for having me.
There she is. The James Museum, I've been doing my research, is just about 5 years old now and is the same age as the St. Pete Catalyst. So I think we basically kind of burst forth from the head of Zeus around the same exact time.
Yes.
So people who moved out of St. Pete in 2017 never heard of either one of us, probably.
Right. Well, we're thrilled to be celebrating our five-year anniversary.
That's in April, isn't it?
It is.
It's this month. Fantastic. We had ours in March.
Okay.
So, okay. Very, very similar sort of thing. Emily, you were there starting in around 2005, I think I read, with Tom and Mary James in their collection of Western art of, you know, I want to say cowboy and Indian art, but that I think that doesn't really do it justice. But art of the American West and depicting the American West. Can we start? And I've spoken with Tom about this before, but I'd like to ask you, why is that their passion? You obviously know them really well. Why do they collect that stuff?
It is unusual to have a Western art museum in Florida. But they are passionate about the stories. Mm-hmm. I think it comes down to nostalgia and stories of the West. So Tom and Mary grew up in the era of Westerns on TV and in the movies. And they love the myths of the West and the realities of the West. And depicting that in art is something that they really gravitated toward when they started visiting out West in the 1980s. So Right. They'd always been collecting art, even when they were dating. How many college kids are actively purchasing art from you know, local fairs and students?
Oh,
and
so many kids I knew in college. I mean, yeah. Kid in the dorm next door had a Picasso on the wall. Come on.
Yeah. So they really had a thought to support living artists so early on, and they just continued to do that and bought art where they traveled. But Mary grew up skiing, and they really made a concerted effort to start going out West more. And naturally, they would go into Western galleries because that's the art.
That became like a part of the courtship, like a let's go out to dinner and buy a new painting while we're out.
Sure.
Kind of thing.
Absolutely.
So this began as not an exhibition, but the collection was on exhibit, if you will, at Raymond James headquarters. Explain that to me. I'm not sure I understand that.
It is a bit of an unusual situation that it's a private collection of art, mm-hmm. But it's hanging in the corporate offices of Raymond James Financial. And because there's more than a million square feet of office space, there's some wall space to hang some work. And so it became this amazing collection over time. It was definitely organic. You know, he didn't always have a museum in mind.
Yeah.
But it's something that employees that work there really love it. And they get attached to it, and they it sparks conversation, and it's a really great aspect of the company culture there. But it also is great for business visitors and anybody else who's coming in. And we actually have community tours that they're now at Raymond James, where visitors can go in and see the art. It's really that special.
Do you remember when the light bulb went off? Let's build a museum, or because this is one of few, you know, privately owned art museums, and there are a couple in St. Petersburg. We had Trish Duggan in here from the Imagine Museum a few weeks ago, and I'm still trying to get Rudy Ciccarello. If you're listening, come on, let's do this. But when was the decision made, let's build something? Let's take it out of the corporate headquarters and take the next step.
There were a lot of conversations around that, and it first started with, well, let's start thinking about a museum and what kind of art might we want to add to the collection that would go into a museum. Mm-hmm. And so because Tom James has always wanted to support living artists and you know, he'd rather buy 20 by somebody who's living and working and support that effort than to purchase something from the 19th century that
a
might be
an
earlier Western piece. And so, but we wanted to tell a few of those earlier stories, mm-hmm. and have the museum be a little more cohesive in that way. And so there was an effort to acquire some of those antecedents that inspired a lot of the artists that have been in the collection a long time. And so it was a slow build up for sure.
Yeah.
But since I started working for Tom, there was a thought there, I'll say that. But around 2010 is when the efforts might have gotten a little more active. And around, I think it was 2015 is when we first visited the building where the current James Museum is.
Do you remember what used to be there? I wasn't living here then, or maybe just moved back, but I don't remember what had been there.
It was several things over time.
Like a JCPenney or something?
I think, so the building was originally supposed to be a department store.
Right.
It never opened as that, but it was going to connect to what is now Sundial and kind of be this corridor of shopping. And it never quite came to fruition, but it was offices for a lot of different, I think Progress Energy was there, a healthcare company or insurance was there, but it was empty when we visited in 2015. So it was available for sale, and it was a huge, massive block of cubicles.
30,000 square feet of gallery space, I think you have said. And that's not counting the offices and storage.
No. So it's more than 80,000.
The Arroyo and the whole entryway. Did you say 80?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, was there ever thought, did Tom and Mary come up there and say, well, yeah, this is great, but it's a little too big?
Yep. They did. that it was definitely not the vision to have it this big initially. It grew. It grew and it grew, but we had a great architect with Jan Weymouth and St. Pete Design Group team, and the programming part just kind of grew. But we have a great event space now where we can house a lot of really wonderful parties, and we have a great auditorium for performances, and we have really great galleries. So it's worked out, I think.
It's, you know, one of the things that I would talk to Laura Hine about, it was the exiting executive director, and to Bernice when she was there, is who preceded Laura, was the building itself is a work of art. And this is something I know you guys like to talk about, the way that Jan designed it. How involved were the Jameses in, you know, the design, working with Jan? Like, I'd like it to look like this.
They definitely had a vision, but Jan took it maybe even to the next level for sure. But he would present different options, and absolutely, we sat around the table and looked at ideas and gave thoughts. And Mary was specifically gave the idea for the front mesa, where it kind of looks like Mesa Verde above the front doors. And because it reminded her of a bracelet that she had of some cliff dwellings. And that was just brought up in a meeting. So it was very organic how it all happened, but it came to fruition. It's
not just a bunch of boxes. Yeah. You know, like you go from this room to that room. It really feels with that. And I love saying the word Arroyo because I've looked it up many times to learn out what it is. And it's sort of like a gully, like carved by moving water. When you walk in, I'm explaining this to you folks if you haven't been there yet. And you should go there, by the way. If you want, when you walk in, it's like you're walking into the Grand Canyon.
Yes.
And that whole sort of motif carries on all the way upstairs into the upper galleries. And it's just an amazing experience. It's not just stuff on a wall.
Yeah. We tried to create an experience and kind of transporting people to the West. I think the canyon experience when you walk in is really interesting. It's got a water feature at the end.
Oh,
and
then
you can go up the stairs. It's kind of like a switchback in a canyon trail. And then all the art is upstairs, most of it anyway.
You have described Western and wildlife art as a genre defined by subject rather than style. Can you explain that? I think I know what it means, but explain it for those who might be listening.
Sure. Well, people have ideas about what Western Americana art is. And a lot of times people think of, say, a cowboy or a bucking bronco, and there's just so much more to it. And I think visitors really experience that when they come in and they see the variety in style that we have, and the variety of subjects, really, and what is Western art. And so we have the opportunity to expand on that. And just like how the West has borders, it's kind of loose. So, you know, even defining what the American West is.
Sure,
you know,
there's a section on maybe Native American life and that kind of culture. Right. And
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to approach Western art, and a lot of the the subjects are historical, and so we're thinking about 19th century, but the West is certainly relevant today. And we have a lot of contemporary work by artists that are thinking about current issues. And it's really exciting to see what they're coming up with and the new perspectives. And so we have a lot of contemporary Native artists, and we have a lot of special exhibitions coming that that address some of the stories that aren't necessarily part of our collection, or maybe we're diving deeper into a certain section.
That's what I wanted to ask you about as curator. When you bring in these special exhibitions, you know, are they seem to me anyway to be specifically, you know, mounted, if you will, to augment what's already there. In other words, they're like different stories of the West. And I wrote some down, which I want to talk about here in a minute. Is that the idea? You know, in other words, to bring in, say, the Indian boarding schools thing that was there a while ago. This is another aspect of life in the West you maybe never thought about before.
Yes. So adding those different perspectives, or maybe untold stories, or little known narratives, it's a great opportunity to do that. So we have one special exhibition gallery. It rotates about 3 times a year, mm-hmm. and it does augment the stories that we have in the collection galleries, but it also brings an opportunity to bring completely new ideas and new art and new artists to the table. So we really put a lot of energy into the special exhibition calendar and what we develop and what we borrow, because it is important. A lot of times that's what's going to drive visitors to come in. So we want something to be interesting for folks. We want something that is a good opportunity to research for us. And maybe it's a story that hasn't been told before. And then sometimes we are borrowing art that is already organized into a show by another institution. And so we work on those calendars sometimes years in advance.
I was thinking about the early days of the James Museum, and it almost seemed like the special exhibitions had to kind of get a running start, that it was a little slow in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Am I remembering this correctly?
Well,
because it's really like gangbusters now for the last, say, 2 years. It's been amazing.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Well, there was just a couple of us early on, and we actually didn't, and literally that means two.
Okay.
But the first special exhibition that we had was opened a few months after we opened. And so my goal was to get us open and plan the galleries. And so we did that. And we've had to kind of find shows that were available quickly and get a few things on the calendar. And then we could start really developing our own, because it takes a long time to develop our own.
That's what I assumed. I'm not an art expert by any means, but I can kind of sense those things, that it's like they're still figuring this out.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
One thing I want to talk about before we talk about a couple of the special exhibitions, including the one that's up now, was the thing called The Crow a Day, Ergo Sum, by Karen Bondarchuk, which I know is a favorite of yours because you always remind me about it when I'm down there. It was very cool. And I think, if I'm not wrong, that kind of falls into that category of something more contemporary that connects with the Western theme. Because can you explain what that was?
Yeah, so the Ergo Sum show was Karen Bondarchuk's project of working through her mother's dementia diagnosis. And it was a real struggle for her. And she decided to paint a crow a day. And so this kind of fell into the wildlife mm-hmm. galleries kind of category.
Of course.
And so
we're talking about one painting a day.
One painting a day for 365 days.
They're very small paintings.
Yes, they are miniatures. Yeah. But the idea was for her to reflect on time and the importance of taking days and remembering. And as her mother was not able to communicate as well, she wanted to just go through this process. And so it became really therapeutic for her. And she ended up with 365 really thoughtful, really wonderful little crow paintings. And so we organized them on the walls with the calendar in mind. And mm-hmm. so they were grouped by month, like as a calendar might show. And it showed the progression of her work. And although her mom has now passed, she did live long enough to see the exhibition. And it was really special, I think. And it's a personal project.
It knocked me up because it's not the sort of thing, I go to art museums to see things that I don't expect, but it's just, wow, what is this? You know, and when you hear that story, it was very powerful looking at all those crows, because they weren't just sort of noble crows. They were upside down and they were flying and they were pecking at stuff. Everyone was different, all 365. Talk to me, if you will, about the stories they tell, which is the one that's up through May 14th.
Yes.
Okay, this is the one that pairs classic photographs taken in the early 20th century with artifacts, and I don't remember the curator's names, but they were really great people, and we had a great talk about it. Talk about this exhibition. Let's tell people about
it. So this exhibition is called The Stories They Tell, Indigenous Art and the Photographs of Edward Curtis, and the photographs kind of set the foundation for the show, and we knew we wanted to use Curtis imagery. But the images that are a part of the show are ones that you might not expect. It might not be his most iconic portraits. If you know some of those, you've probably seen them before.
He did some of those sort of Sitting Bull there and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
So his sepia toned images of Native Americans. He traveled for more than 30 years around the West and documented many tribes through images and recordings and journals. And anyway, Caitlin Pendola, who's a colleague of mine, worked on this show and led the pairings of Edward Curtis imagery with the indigenous art and material culture that was found all over the West. And it was from the time that the Curtis photos were taken at the turn of the century all the way up to this year. Mm-hmm. So one of the new images that are the new works of art that were part of the exhibition was commissioned by the museum, and it's a large projection piece by Marianne Nicholson.
So I like that one on the wall there. Yeah.
It's completely unexpected. And so, you know, Curtis's work feels like it was a long time ago, and it gives a lot of information. They're beautiful, but we wanted to bring it to today too.
One of the things, here's what I remember when I was there, is there'd be a Curtis photograph of an old woman making a pot. And you're nodding because you know what I'm talking about. And then in the case there, it's maybe not the pot, but it's similar, because there are still people in that culture making these for sale now. So you can go, maybe this is an old one, maybe this is a new one, but it's the same pot. Right. And that gives it a third dimension. You're right. Oh, my God, look at that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of that and different sort of ornamental things and clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Those
mm-hmm.
robes were unbelievable. This is an incredible exhibit.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So there's weavings, there's pottery, there's baskets. And I think it does show sometimes the similar, we'll say pot for an example, but it really shows that the tradition has continued and that it's maybe grown and evolved, but the tradition is still there. And artists are thinking about it in new ways, and they're incorporating maybe different materials or a different way to think about a tradition. And so it's really something that is special. There's more than, I think, almost 200 works of art in the exhibition. And so it really shows a lot of work and a lot of just evolving of cultures.
One of the things that I thought was very special about the last exhibition, which was Black Pioneers, Legacy in the American West, was that quilt exhibition, which sort of brought a different part of Western history into the forefront, which I think maybe people weren't aware of too much. Can we talk about that one a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this idea came to us through Carolyn Maslumi, who organized the Women of Color Quilters Network Group. She and, gosh, I'm thinking now it's been more than 40 quilters were a part of the show. And they each took a topic and they presented it.
From history.
In a quilt, yeah.
Yeah.
From Black history in the American West.
Right.
And some of the topics were uncomfortable. Some of them were difficult to talk about.
Yeah.
And there's something about quilts where it's a softer, warmer avenue to explore these subjects and these stories. And I tell you, these quilters are phenomenal. And that's now traveling. So we're really proud of that. And that show is traveling around the country.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's in Georgia right now. It's about to head to California. And so people across the country will be able to see it. And we were able to develop that show with Mezlumi.
And then there are the classics, and I'm talking about the joint exhibition of Silver, Jutland, Prince from Ansel Adams and the great Clyde Butcher. That show, that was a jaw dropper. So I could point to several folks that I know who said they had never been in the James Museum before, but that's the one that made them go look at it.
They did. Our attendance numbers went up
considerably.
Go.
These are incredible landscape photographers. Ansel Adams, of course, from a previous generation. Mr. Butcher, who is thankfully still with us, shot all sorts of Big Cypress Swamp and aspects of Florida, but I think he did all sorts of landscapes too. And
yeah, he went all over the country.
Yeah, he did. He did. I remember when he did a thing with this place where Dali used to live in Spain. And yeah, you're probably familiar with that. And I think maybe the Dali Museum had that. It's probably mm-hmm. where I saw that. But amazing. Both of these guys, masters of black and white photography, and just a brilliant exhibition. So you had record numbers for that one? Is that what
yeah,
you said?
Yeah, it was amazing. So we there's that name recognition with Ansel Adams.
Well, that's always a thing. Yeah, sure.
Clyde Butcher has the local following. And I tell you, he can draw a crowd when mm-hmm. he came to speak.
Yeah.
We're so grateful that he was able to come. I mean, there were hundreds of people in our event space. It was wonderful to see everybody together.
You do have the theater, which seats, what is it, 150, 200 people? A beautiful little theater.
About 130, I think. It's beautiful. The acoustics are amazing. We've shown a lot of movies there.
Mm-hmm. You actually had me come down an intro movie once.
There you go.
I'm waiting for my second invitation, by the way.
Noted.
Yeah.
But we've had a lot of great artist talks there, and it's a fun part of our programming at the James because we do have so many living artists in the collection, and so we can invite them
come. Oh, I hadn't thought of that,
course. It's an amazing part of programming, and even during COVID, it really propelled us to connect with these artists. So even if it was by Zoom or phone, we were able to record more artists than we ever had before. It really gave us some wind in our wings to really make sure we record these people before they do pass. Well, and it's amazing to get their perspectives.
You have a lot of music there. It's like maybe Tuesday nights or something in the auditorium.
Yeah, and you got it. $10 Tuesdays.
And I can't remember the name of the Black Cowboys guy, but I've spoken with him several times.
Dom Flemons.
And what a cool guy. And you've also got Opera Cowgirls coming.
Yeah.
Near the end of April. What they do, we were talking before we came on here, is essentially they're opera singers who sing sort of harmony, country music harmonies. They also happen to be just playing great singers and instrumentalists, and that's a lot of fun.
Good.
Fair enough.
Hey, we also have live music coming on the actual 5th anniversary. So 6 Volt Rodeo and Swing Time will be at the James on Friday, the 28th of April. Admission's only $5 to celebrate 5 years.
The 5-year anniversary is coming up April 28th.
It
Did
is.
You get that, folks? This is news to me, too. Hey, and we're going to remind you before we go about that one more time. You are in search mode for the next executive director. And Laura Hine has been involved with the Jameses for a long time. And
yes.
has talked to me about it and expressed her desire, you know, just to move on and do other things.
Laura has been a really amazing part of our team. We're very grateful for her leadership. She's been our director for, I think, a little more than 3 years now. And but part of that, of course, before that was the building.
Yeah.
And she was project director to really get the museum open. So that was amazing. So I've known her a number of years now. Mm-hmm. And we were just talking this morning, and I think we might have met 10 or 12 years ago. And I tell you, she's a really special person. And I think she's a really good leader. I think she's going to go on to do some really, really amazing things.
I think Laura may rule the world one day. In other words. Hey, Emily Capus, we're kind of... See, I pronounced your name correctly that time. I've called her Knapes. I've called her Capus. I've called her Capistrano. But it's Capus, and she is the curator of art at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art, which is celebrating its 5th anniversary, April 28th, with a whole day full of special and very cool stuff. What's the website?
TheJamesMuseum.org.
So check it all out there. And if you haven't had a chance to investigate it, you really need to do that. And go before April 28th, too, when all the crowds are going to be there. So, Emily, thank you so very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.